Welcome to the China Desk Podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire, with your host, Steve Yates.
Welcome to the China Desk Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Yates, Senior Research Fellow for China and National Security at the Heritage Foundation. A reminder to our audience, for whom we are most grateful, viewers can watch the China Desk on YouTube or subscribe to hear all our interviews on Apple, Spotify, and most other podcast providers. We welcome you to check out our website and show archive at chinadeskpodcast.com. My guest today is Benedict Rogers, a human rights activist, author, journalist, with more than two decades of experience focusing on Asia. He currently serves as senior director at Fortify Rights, where he helps guide the organization's work on human rights issues in China, Hong Kong, Myanmar, North Korea, and across the region. He was the co-founder of Hong Kong Watch, where he served as chief executive until 2024, playing a central role in bringing global attention to Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong's freedoms. He previously spent 30 years with Christian Solidarity Worldwide, specializing in East Asia advocacy. He is the author of The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny, Tan Shui, Unmasking Burma's Tyrant, Burma, A Nation at the Crossroads, and Live Without Evil, Stopping the Genocide of Burma's Karen People. I think with those books, you get a sense of kind of the two roads that have brought us to the conversation today, human rights generally on Burma, and China's influence, which is not divorced from the Burma question. But with all of that, Benedict, welcome to the China Desk. Let's jump in.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, I have been looking forward to this conversation for some time. I follow the work that you do and the commentary you have on social media, and I think our audience is going to really enjoy the point of view that you bring to today's conversation. But as I foretold in our pre-taping, we like our audience to get to know the human beings behind the meat of our conversations before we get into the thick of things. And you've lived what I consider to be a really interesting life, aside from the policy advocacy things. But maybe share a little bit about what your journey was, how, you know, the circumstances in which you grew up. And was it obvious that when you reached a certain age, you would be going out into the world and championing human rights? Or were you being raised to maybe be a doctor or a lawyer?
Well, I grew up in a very happy, fortunate family. And one aspect that was particularly fortunate was that my parents were quite well traveled. My father traveled a lot for business. My mother had actually briefly been a diplomat in West Africa and then had lived in Japan. And they took myself and my sister on interesting holidays as we were growing up. So I think I developed a real interest in the wider world from an early age. I also developed a real interest in current affairs and a love of both reading and writing at a fairly young age. And the way I got into Asia and China specifically was essentially that when I was approaching the age of 18, I decided to do something that's quite common, at least in the UK, which is what we call a gap year. So instead of going directly to university, I took a year out between high school and university, and I wanted to go to a part of the world that I had never been to before, and I also wanted to do something kind of constructive. I didn't want to just go backpacking. I wanted to do something educational and hopefully contributing to others. And my dad came home from work one evening, and he had been talking to a colleague of his whose daughter had taught English in China. And China was actually the one country, even though my family was very well traveled, it was the one country that no one in the family had been to. So there was a kind of sense of, on the one hand, I grew up in this well traveled family, but on the other, I was doing something new and different that the rest of the family hadn't. And so I applied for a place, got it, and ended up in Qingdao in China for 6 months at the age of 18 to teach English.
And what year markers are we to have a sort of frame of reference for the China that you were about to experience?
Yeah, so it was 1992. So only 3 years after the Tiananmen massacre, but at the same time also a time where there was a sense that despite the terrible, tragic Tiananmen Square massacre, in certain ways, China was beginning to open up more. In Qingdao, it was interesting because I went for weeks without seeing another foreigner. So in that sense, it was before the kind of influx of foreigners. But at the same time, it was beginning to open up.
So also confessing, since I know a little bit about your focus of work and your personal journey, what was sort of the influence that drew you into human rights particularly? Because one of the things that I think the audience ought to know is I think you really bring a very human and individual perspective into how to understand some of these countries, governments, and world affairs that we deal with. So a lot of experts kind of come from the macro down into the micro, but I've always seen your angle of vision very much out from the human experience. So correct me if I'm wrong on that, but somewhere along the way, you must have picked this up as, hey, this is what I'm passionate about, and there's something I feel like I need to address.
Absolutely. I think it was beginning to develop in my late teens in part being in China at the age of 18 and being not directly involved, but certainly aware of the dynamics of life in China and conversations that I would have with Chinese friends who would talk within the privacy of their own homes about how they felt about the Chinese Communist Party. But I wasn't really active in human rights until I went on to university. And the turning point really was a speaker in my university chapel in, I think, the second semester of my time in my first year. And she was an amazing parliamentarian called Baroness Cox, who has been one of the most courageous voices for human rights, not particularly on China, but on other parts of the world. And I heard her speak. She actually spoke about Sudan, a little bit, I think, about Burma, and also about Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian enclave that there was a war going on between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And I just sat there and listened to her and had this overwhelming sense of this is so compelling. I need to do something. And I spoke to her afterwards. I found myself actually going to war-torn Nagorno-Karabakh a few months later with her and US Congressman Frank Wolf. And I think through that experience, but building on my China experience, that led me into human rights. Initially, for quite some years, I wasn't very vocal on China for the reason that many people have, which is that I wanted to continue to go to China. And so I was more involved with Burma and I became involved with North Korea. But then there was a turning point with China soon after Xi Jinping came to power, where I realized things were really deteriorating and I needed to speak up. So that's my journey through human rights.
Yeah, well, I think it's an important journey. And I think a lot of our guests and a lot of our fellow travelers have had some elements of these things. But one of the other parts of your journey that I think is useful context is also, I know of you by way of international religious freedom conferences, and not just in human rights, but your faith journey and the issue of religious freedom seem to take a higher order of magnitude in your work and your commentary at some point along the way. To the extent you're comfortable, please share a little bit about what that particular arc was for you.
Absolutely. Well, I would say that both my personal faith journey and my passion for religious freedom are very intertwined with my commitment to broader human rights as well. So the encounter with Baroness Cox came just a few months after I had had a personal faith conversion. I became a Christian at university. She was leading at that time an organization called Christian Solidarity Worldwide, CSW, which champions religious freedom for everyone, not simply for Christians. But that was really my entry point into human rights. And then my passion and concern became broader. The other dimension to my faith journey is that for about 19 years, I worshipped as an Anglican in Church of England churches. But through my friendship with the Cardinal of Burma, Cardinal Charles Bowe, that's a whole other story, which I'll keep short. But essentially, he inspired me to explore Catholicism. And then I ended up being received into the Catholic Church by Cardinal Bowe in 2013, with actually another parliamentarian who's a champion of human rights and religious freedom, Lord Alton, David Alton, as my sponsor. So he came out to Burma with me. And then I discovered through being a Catholic, the richness of the Catholic Church's teachings on human rights, human dignity, justice, and that further fueled my commitment to human rights.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I hope people might understand one of the reasons why I ask about that is partly because I like it, but also because if people just use Google and are looking for the prominent conversations about Benedict Rogers, they might be excused for seeing a lot about you in Hong Kong. And one of the interesting, if not oddities, about the democracy movement in Hong Kong and politics in Hong Kong is that there are a lot of prominent Catholic leaders that are in that mix. And people might have thought, well, obviously your faith journey had to do with Hong Kong Watch and getting active in Hong Kong. I love the sort of who to thunk it. It was actually a Burma experience and connection that was this window. But before I get ahead of things on the Hong Kong side of things, I also think you have a really interesting experience on your early encounter with China after Tiananmen and the attempts to sort of reopen. There was the Deng Xiaoping era of opening, the shock of Tiananmen, and there was sort of an economic crisis and some sanctions and political isolation that was kind of more temporary than people might have accepted. And then post 92, things really were, there was a concerted effort to have another round of opening and rebranding of China in certain ways. You had to have had some encounters with the CCP through that period, and you've now written a book that talks prominently about the CCP. And I'd like to get into that part of the conversation. But talk a little bit about what the early years were like, about how you saw, perceived, and interacted with the CCP. And then at some point, you must have started to get mugged by them, and the tables shifted a bit. But talk first for perspective about what those early impressions and understandings were.
Yes, well, after my 6 months in Qingdao in 1992, I would say I fell in love with China. And one thing I would want to emphasize is the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, will describe people like me as being anti-China, but that's totally untrue. I'm far from being anti-China. I love China. I have many friends in China. It's the CCP and its repression that I'm anti. And because of my sort of falling in love with China at the age of 18, I then spent many years from 92 right up until 2017, when I was denied entry to Hong Kong, and we may come back to that. But over those years, traveling regularly in China, firstly as a journalist, my first job was in Hong Kong, and I lived there for 5 years just after the handover, 97 to 2002. And then even in my human rights work on Burma and on North Korea, I traveled regularly to China to go to the China-Burma border and the North Korea border. I would say that through the 90s and into the early to mid 2000s, my impression was genuinely that China was moving in a more hopeful direction. I was never under any illusions that the CCP, by definition, is a communist dictatorship, and instinctively I'm for democracy. So I was never a fan of the CCP by any means, but I did have the impression that things were relaxing. There were things that you could do that weren't previously possible. There was some sense of civil society emerging and some level of independent media and bloggers and lawyers. And then along came Xi Jinping. And of course, the crackdown was building up before Xi Jinping. It wasn't just him alone, but he turbocharged it. And all of that space for civil society that had been growing disappeared. Many of the people themselves actually disappeared, human rights defenders and lawyers. And I then also saw what was happening in Hong Kong around the umbrella movement in 2014. And just had an overwhelming sense that I need to speak out and use my voice because of my relationship with Hong Kong. And I did so in the full knowledge that it very likely would mean I wouldn't be able to go back to China. I didn't actually expect Hong Kong to unravel as rapidly as it did, but I decided I had to speak out. So I had those glimmers of hope through the 90s and early 2000s, and then a total change of direction, or not a total change of direction, but a real acceleration of repression under Xi.
Well, we've had a lot of guests, and it's also the opinion that I share that Xi is an inflection point that I think you rightly point to the notion that there were elements that were building through all of that. But there is something very different under the leadership of Xi Jinping. And I guess that's a good segue into the book. And when you look at just even the title of the book, The China Nexus, 30 Years In and Around the Communist Party's Tyranny. So you're talking about your personal journey. You've given us the lead up and you've given us a little bit of the taste of what things have been like. There are several core messages in your book that I think are worthy of conversation, but I don't want to put the words in your mouth. As you worked on this, as somewhat of a life's journey and a message, what would you say to people about what the core understandings of the CCP are that leaders need to take in, and what do you think are some of the biggest misses that leaders tend to have when thinking about the CCP?
I think the core messages about the CCP are that today it is I think the biggest threat to freedom around the world that there is. There are, of course, other threats. We see what's happening in Ukraine with Putin's invasion there. We see regimes like North Korea and Burma. But in many ways, the CCP underpins all of those. It's facilitating the war in Ukraine. It's keeping alive the regimes in Burma and North Korea and elsewhere. I think in terms of the CCP's values, in some ways, its values probably never changed, but I think Xi Jinping has given them, has lifted the lid on them and has really placed them front and center. And those are complete hostility to democracy, to human rights, and to religion. It's fiercely anti-religion. What we've seen under Xi Jinping, there was a key foundational document published very early on in his regime, called document, the exciting name of document number 9, which puts on paper what I guess we've always known about the CCP, but it's there now in black and white, that it opposes all of our values, free press, independent judiciary, civil society, the idea of universal human rights. And it is not just severely repressive at home, repressive of all its people, both the majority Han Chinese, anyone who shows any dissent, any freedom of expression, but also, of course, the various territories that at various stages in its history it has invaded and occupied. So the region that is the Uyghurs region, known to the CCP as Xinjiang, known to the Uyghurs as East Turkestan, has now become a place that where a genocide has taken place, and that genocide is recognized by both of the recent US administrations and others in the world. The repression in Tibet has intensified. Again, the dismantling of Hong Kong's freedoms. and also the aggression towards Taiwan and increasing aggression. So it's at home a very repressive regime, but it's also increasingly aggressive abroad. It has a campaign of transnational repression against its critics around the world, and it's trying to disrupt and steal intellectual property and so on. So it is, I think, the biggest threat to freedom in the world today.
Well, in trying to get a handle on this, you engage regularly in person by media or otherwise with people who are in leadership positions in government and politics. What do you find to be the biggest gaps or hindrances for them to recognize and accept the view that you've just outlined?
I think the biggest gap and hindrance is this obsession with China as a market, as one of the most significant economies in the world, as a vital trading partner, and particularly in this time of economic challenge, especially in the UK and Europe, there is an understandable tendency to look to new markets and new opportunities for growth and for trade and investment. But I think the mistake, there are two mistakes. The first is to put all our eggs in one basket. There's a tendency to focus so much on China instead of diversifying both our markets and our supply chains. And the second is to make the assumption that in order to do business with China, we have to kowtow to them, we have to stop criticizing them, we have to in some way undermine or curtail our values. And I just don't think that's true, because I think ultimately, however aggressive the CCP is, they will do business on the same terms anyone else does business, which is that we have things they want to buy or they have products they want to sell. And so we should be much bolder in standing up for our values. I don't think it's realistic to say we should stop doing business completely, but we should certainly be looking at what sectors are they a particular threat to, and limiting their involvement in those sectors, and just being stronger about our values. I think also to add to that, my feeling is the CCP actually, of course, they don't like it when you criticize them, but I think deep down, they actually have more respect for you when you do stand up for yourselves, when you kowtow and grovel and sacrifice values. I think they lose all respect and they just think they can walk all over you. So those are the mistakes people make.
It's very similar to the experience I've had too. I firmly believe that the tougher the names they use to describe you, the sharper the elbows they throw, in a way are almost a backhanded form of respect. Because no one knows the shortcomings of their system better than they do. And they can tell whether you are capable of seeing them and if you have the moxie to tell the truth in the face of really wanting to engage in some kind of exchange, whether that exchange is in policymaking or business or what have you. And I just repeatedly have found people who have very tough views about China to actually be in some ways the best positioned to have real negotiations and talks with China's leadership. And the reverse also true. Those that whitewash whatever is going on or ignore the harm they might be causing in your own country, they lose respect and seek greater advantage. So I appreciate you summing that up, because it's one of those things where I feel like I've personally witnessed from an American government point of view and otherwise. In a way, it's rewarding to see it replicated. In a way, it's sad to see it replicated, because it just reminds me of how many different areas the same formula is being used. And your way of thinking, which I admire and try to resemble, is in the minority. We have a majority of CEOs, a majority of elected politicians, and those even sometimes in broader civil society organizations that don't speak up on these things. But as I lay out a few of those areas, I'd really like to dive a bit deeper into your sense of how the CCP's operations and reach have evolved. Again, not trying to put too many words into your mouth, but if I look at where things were in 1992, the CCP's global reach was incidental in my estimation. Whereas if we look in 2025, everyday news cycles in the United States and the UK will have things that are happening in our own countries that are attributable to the CCP. Can you share a little bit about your particular front row seat to what are some of the ways that this change in the CCP's global reach has manifested itself in your country? And what are some of the ways your leaders are either doing well or less well in responding?
Yeah, absolutely. The change in the 30 years that I've been involved with China has been very significant. When I first went in 1992, it was a country where there was still a lot of poverty. It was trying to open up. And in a sense, it was needing our help to enter into the global economy. Now, I would say it controls much of the global economy. Or at least it creates the impression that it does. I actually think sometimes we overestimate its power, but we shouldn't underestimate it either. So, for example, in the UK, where I'm speaking to you from, right now there is a major crisis that has developed because two individuals have been accused of spying for China. One of those individuals was a staffer in Parliament for two very senior members of Parliament, and they were then arrested, charged with spying. They were about to go on trial, and the prosecution case collapsed because the British government, at least this is what's being reported, the British government refused to provide some particular evidence stating the level of threat that China poses, provide that evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service, the Director of Public Prosecutions, and the Director of Public Prosecutions felt that they couldn't proceed with the case without all of the evidence that they needed. Now, it's subsequently emerged that actually they still had a huge amount of evidence, and questions are being asked about why they chose not to proceed. But all of that, I think, is just one example of how our leaders appear to feel that they must prioritize the economic relationship with China rather than defending our security, our values, and our judicial process. And I think in different ways that is playing out across many of our democracies, where China presents a huge security threat. An espionage threat, a transnational repression threat, and it's something that we must wake up to and confront.
Well, I, my perception is that we're in the gradual process of waking up a bit more broadly to this, and some jurisdictions more along the path than others. Certainly, it seems like there's been a crescendo in conversation about this in the UK. I would say even just over the last 6 to 12 months, there seems to have been an increase, but you could correct that perspective if I'm off. But one of the core messages I took away from your book, but also just your broader work, builds on what you were just alluding to. You are an advocate for democracy, human rights, and moral causes being central to great power politics and dealings rather than being a secondary part of what we do. You are very mindful of people who would frame international relations in other ways about great power politics, leading with national interest, usually by military hard power or economic hard power and nature of the state and some of these civil society issues as being secondary. And I think we're in an era, leaving personalities of leaders out, of a revival of more of that realist foreign policy prioritization. I don't personally necessarily see these views as in conflict as they might first appear. But I'd like you to maybe draw out a little bit more about your case for making human rights and the moral causes central, and how that might fit into a successful way of the world under our current circumstances.
Well, I think it's really important not to focus solely on one particular aspect, but to bring all the considerations together. So, as you say, definitely focusing on the moral human rights issues, but realizing that that's part of a realistic approach, because the way the CCP represses its people at home is the way that it would treat others if it had the opportunity to do so. So, for example, if it did, and I hope this never happens, but if it did invade Taiwan, we have a vision of the future for Taiwan under that situation by looking at China today. And that then plays into all our other considerations about geopolitical issues, security, our own interests. And I just think that it is in our own interest to defend our values of freedom and human rights. If we want them for ourselves, we should defend them for others as well. So I'm not against those who choose to prioritize the other considerations, but I would just argue we should put them all together and take a holistic approach to foreign policy.
Sounds reasonable to me. I'd also argue that even when we're looking at technology and the economic interactions, the lack of transparency, accountability, and free speech is actually a toxic foundation on which to build an AI future. And so it's in many ways impossible to divorce the realities of the nature of the CCP system from the economic and technological interdependence we may be inviting. That may be an area where, again, reminding people about having moral clarity and objective clarity about what we're dealing with is an important wake-up call. And when it comes to great power politics, obviously we've lived through a pretty sad episode with a protracted Russian reinvasion of Ukraine. And as you said early in our conversation, China is very much a part of the Russia war machine in extending that conflict. And so the nature of the regime is informing what its power politics are at this point. And then on top of it, there's the diagnosis of Xi Jinping. So with that, I can't let this conversation go by without addressing some of your background, which I love. And I think actually anecdotally talks about a few of the things that I'd like to address before we wind. One is a giant Winnie the Pooh. For those who don't know, and shame on anyone who's listened to the China Desk this many episodes and not knowing references to Winnie the Pooh, talk a little bit about why you have Winnie the Pooh back there and what it means to you.
Yeah, I grew up as a child very fond of Winnie the Pooh, but that's not the reason I have him on my bookcase behind me. There's a very particular political message here, which is that some years ago, Winnie the Pooh was basically banned in China shortly after, I think, I was denied entry to Hong Kong. So I feel a certain solidarity with Winnie the Pooh for that reason. And the reason he was banned was that somebody had drawn a comparison between President Obama at the time and Xi Jinping, and portrayed Xi Jinping as resembling Winnie the Pooh, which I actually think is quite an insult to Winnie the Pooh. But that's the background to it. And this particular Winnie the Pooh behind me was actually given to me when I was in Taiwan. I think it might have been actually on the trip where you and I met in Taiwan together. But I was given it by someone one evening, and I thought, well, this is a symbolic thing to have on my bookcase.
Well, I love the way you defend Winnie the Pooh's honor by the unfair comparison to Xi Jinping rather than the other way around. The other image, three other images. The other image that I turn to next is the Dalai Lama. And it brings up a number of different thoughts in my mind. But talk a little bit about why you have a picture of His Holiness over one of your shoulders.
Well, I was incredibly fortunate a couple of years ago to have the opportunity to go to Dharamsala, where the Tibetan government in exile and His Holiness have been based for decades. And the reason I went, I have a wonderful publisher of the China Nexus, Dean Baxendale, who's a Canadian publisher. And I always say about Dean that he's someone who has crazy ideas, but crazy ideas of two types, those that are not deliverable at all, and those that may be, on first impression, crazy, but actually are doable. And when the book was launched, the launch in London was actually the day that Rishi Sunak became prime minister. It was the very day he took office. And Dean rang me up that morning. We had the launch party in the evening. And he said, why don't we go down to 10 Downing Street and try and get a copy of the book into the hands of the new prime minister? And I said, Dean, that's totally crazy and impossible. Well, there's no way we would get anywhere near the prime minister. But then he said a little while later, why don't we go to Dharamsala and present the book to the Dalai Lama? And I said, well, actually, that's not impossible. And so we were able to do it. I had also been able to interview His Holiness when I was writing the book. The interview was done in writing through his office, but he provided answers to some questions and gave me permission to quote him exclusively in the book. So, and he's just somebody, as I think every listener would agree, that is one of the truly great figures of our time, one of the truly great moral leaders, and a huge inspiration. So it was a privilege to meet him, and wonderful to have the photograph with him.
Yeah. Oh, I had my own trip to Dharamsala, where in the Punjab area, I think I experienced the most activist form of the TSA, the transportation security apparatus. It was a very thorough screening, I will say, going through there before getting up into the mountains to reach Dharamsala. But over your other shoulder, I believe, if I'm looking correctly, is that Pope John Paul II?
It's actually Pope Francis.
There we go.
And I have mixed feelings, I would say. The reason I had the privilege of meeting him a number of times, actually. And I feel a closeness to Pope Francis because he became Pope, I think, about 10 days before I became a Catholic. So I kind of grew up as a Catholic with Pope Francis. And there's much about him that I love and admire. I did take a very different view on China from the position he took, and I've written about this publicly, so this is not new, but I was disappointed with his position on China, the agreement that the Vatican did with China, and particularly his repeated failure to speak up on any of the issues that we've been discussing. Even though he spoke up on injustices and human rights in most other parts of the world. But despite all that, I still have the photograph behind me.
Well, and just continue that Catholic connection. We'll now go to the last image that's above you and says Free Jimmy Lai. Now, Jimmy Lai is someone we've both had the privilege to know, and his life story is one we've frequently encouraged people to take in. We featured a biographer in talking about Jimmy's work. We've also just followed the unending time in solitary confinement that he's currently still enduring. But talk to the audience a little bit about Free Jimmy Lai and why Jimmy is kind of right above your head.
Absolutely. Well, I've had the privilege of knowing Jimmy for a number of years. He, again, is one of the most inspirational people I've met. He's 78 years old. He's actually a British citizen. His only passport is a British passport. And yet he has been in solitary confinement for the last 5 years, simply for, as the head of his international legal team often puts it, the crime of committing journalism and the crime of speaking about democracy. He founded the Apple Daily newspaper, the largest and most influential pro-democracy newspaper in Hong Kong, which, of course, has been shut down. And I think the key thing about Jimmy that is really amazing is that he became a very successful man, a very wealthy man, having come from a very poor background. And he could at any point have, prior to his arrest, have left Hong Kong. He had properties around the world. He had every opportunity to get out, but he chose not to. He chose to stay with his people, and he's been in prison for the last 5 years. He hasn't even been sentenced under the national security law. And when that comes sometime in the next few months, he is very likely to receive a sentence that will either literally or in effect be a life sentence. And I just say one last point, because we were talking about Pope Francis, who never spoke about Jimmy Lai. I've been very encouraged just very recently to see that Pope Leo has actually met Jimmy Lai's wife and daughter at a general audience in Rome. So that's a very encouraging sign. But Jimmy, of course, is a devout Catholic as well as a courageous democracy activist.
Well, I thank you very much for sharing some of these fun anecdotes about the images that are behind you, but also the awful lot that whatever I left out of the conversation, I apologize to the audience. That's my fault, because there's a lot we could have covered in today's conversation. But before we wrap, offer to you any parting thoughts that I failed to ask, or any final thoughts you'd like to share before we wrap.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I would encourage listeners, if they would like to read The China Nexus. It's, in addition to being available in English, of course, it's actually been translated into Chinese by a Taiwanese publisher, and it's in Polish as well. So it's available in those languages. I would just encourage people to take seriously the issues we've been talking about today. To use their positions of influence to try to shift thinking, not against China, the country, but against the CCP. And if people would like to follow my work, I'm quite active on Twitter or X, just with my name at Benedict Rogers. And the organizations that I'm associated with are all available online, Fortify Rights, Hong Kong Watch. So I hope people will engage with these issues.
I certainly encourage them to do so. To our audience, if you've enjoyed today's conversation, please subscribe, tell your friends, and give a visit to ChinaDeskPodcast.com. We thank you very much for listening in and watching on YouTube. Special thank you to Benedict Rogers for sharing his perspective. Until next time, I'm Steve Yates, your host here at the China Desk.
Thank you for listening to the China Desk Podcast, presented by the Federal Newswire and hosted by Steve Yates. Check out the Federal Newswire's family of websites, as well as their social media stream.